country, take your effing arse back to your own country. I'm an American citizen. Or re-educate your regurgitated garbage. This is really, really weaponized stuff. And the prototypical example of, you're not going to sit down with this person. I'm going to say this guy. Almost everyone who sends stuff like this is male. You're not going to sit down with this guy and have a rational conversation and get him to say, you know what, right? I was wrong. You were right. I'm glad that you explained things to me the way they are. It's just not happening. And so it gets us once again to the question of, how do you deprogram that? How do you do it? I don't have the answer, but we've talked with a lot of people who claim to have some ideas. They say the only answer is long term of building relationships with these folks. I don't have the stomach for it, I think is the way I would say. And I know many of you have folks like these in your family. I'm sorry to hear that. We've got a great bonus show for you today. Sign up at joinpacman.com. You'll get instant access. And you can email me info@davidpacman.com. Keep it nice. Keep it nice. Give me something productive. We'll see you on the...
This is Danny Glover, and you're listening to 88.3 FM WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hello, this is Adam Clayton here, the bass player from U2. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hey, this is Steve Archer.
And Donna Lynch.
From Ego Likeness, you're listening to WRCT Radio.
No, it's E. Dueto from the Love Dogs, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Hey, this is Ben Foles, and you're listening to WRCT. It's 2 for Tuesday, 3 for Thursday, Ladies Night Wet T-Shirt Contest on 88.3 FM, biatch.
Thank you.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
WRCT Pittsburgh, music for your inner robot.
WRCT Pittsburgh, we won't respect you in the morning.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Hi, you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, home of... Oh, crap. We're not really home of anything, are we, Andrew?
From New York, Rock Raider.
Yeah, yeah, 1-2, Total Eclipse.
From Executioners, and we're chilling on WRCT.
Word up, Pittsburgh representing 88.3 FM.
Check it out,
dial. Aight, peace.
Yo, there's only 6 degrees of separation, and we know 5 people you know. How much longer did you really think you could avoid strict flow? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. Like this!
Top Dog in Pittsburgh, WRCT.
Senator John McCain, and I'm from Arizona. But when I'm in Pittsburgh, I always listen to WRCT, one of the finest stations in all of radio. And Carnegie Mellon University is one of the finest academic institutions in our country. Be sure at your next election to vote early and vote often.
I'm Fear the Deliverance Strangers, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh!
This is Satan. You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM.
Hi there. This is MC Honky, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT is on AOL Instant Messenger. Our screen name is WRCT883. Send us a shout out so we can make fun of your atrocious spelling. Send us a request. Send us anything. We're bored. WRCT 88.3 FM on your radio, WRCT.org on the internet, and now WRCT 883 on AOL Instant Messenger. In the language of the kids today, we're the bomb. That's right, isn't it? That's what the kids say. We're the bomb, correct? Okay.
Hey, we're the 1985, and whenever we're in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, we like to pick up 13-year-old runaways at the Greyhound station and listen to WRCT! Woo!
WRCT Pittsburgh. The last bastion of pulchritude.
Is Mark G. of the Evolution Control Committee, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, where the drunken pants are going wild.
We'll give you total control over our lives. Everyone shuts the hell up.
We're Hydra! WRCT!
You're listening to WRCT, Friends of the FCC. Good friends, good times, and eggnog.
RCT Pittsburgh. No one is as excited about flaming cheese as we are.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This year alone, we have seen nearly 600 restrictions introduced in 47 states. So no matter where you live, no matter where you are, this fight is at your doorstep right now.
Bans off our bodies. Thousands marched Saturday in more than 600 demonstrations across the United States in a national day of action to protect abortion rights and protest Texas's near total ban on abortions. We'll speak to Planned Parenthood President Alexis McGill Johnson, plus hear moving testimony of Congressmembers Pramila Jayapal, Barbara Lee, and Cori Bush sharing their personal stories about having an abortion.
So to all the black women and girls who have had abortions and will have abortions, we have nothing to be ashamed of. We live in a society that has failed to legislate love and justice for us. So we deserve better. We demand better. We are worthy of better.
Plus, we hear Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg and Ugandan climate activist Vanessa Nakate speaking at a UN climate event in Milan, Italy.
Historically, Africa is responsible for only 3% of global emissions. And yet Africans are already suffering some of the most brutal impacts fueled by the climate crisis.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Hundreds of rallies took place across the United States Saturday amidst a mounting assault on reproductive rights. The protests and marches came 1 month after Texas' near-total ban on abortions went into effect. This is a demonstrator in Austin, Texas.
They've been trying to fight Roe v. Wade for nearly 50 years now. And I'll be honest, when it happened, I thought, the Supreme Court's going to have to knock it down again. And when they didn't, it was, we have to fight. It just goes to show why elections matter. And so we have to get back out of the streets and we have to march and we have to organize and we have to fight.
A federal judge in Texas is now considering arguments from the Justice Department over whether to suspend the Texas ban while courts consider its legality. After headlines were hill clips of Saturday's nationwide protests, and speak with Alexis McGill Johnson, president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. The U.S. has surpassed 700,000 confirmed COVID-19 deaths. The official death toll is by far the highest in the world, even though the U.S. has had widespread access to life-saving vaccines for months. In brighter news, the summer's devastating surge fueled by the Delta variant slowing down, though some northern states are still reporting rising cases. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom announced the first in the nation COVID vaccine mandate for K-12 students. The mandate takes effect as early as next fall and after regulators approve its use in all affected age groups. Meanwhile, the New York City teacher vaccine mandate goes into effect today. The city said 93% of teachers have now received at least one dose. On Friday, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor denied an emergency appeal by a group of educators who were seeking to halt the vaccine mandate while their lawsuit against the order plays out in court. In Southern California, an oil pipeline ruptured off the coast of Huntington Beach Saturday, causing a massive spill that fouled beaches and wetlands with more than 125,000 gallons of oil. Huntington Beach Mayor Kim Carr called the disaster one of the most devastating situations faced by the community in decades.
The company responsible for this oil spill, which we understand to be Beta Offshore, a California subsidiary of Houston-based Amplify Energy Corporation, is working on the cleanup effort as well. In the coming days and weeks, we challenge the responsible parties to do everything possible to rectify this environmental catastrophe.
Dead birds and marine animals have begun washing ashore on Huntington Beach. The affected area includes an ecological reserve that's home to dozens of bird species. A massive coordinated leak of nearly 12 million secret documents is giving an unprecedented look at the covert financial dealings of hundreds of politicians, billionaires, religious leaders, drug lords, and celebrities. 35 current and former world leaders are featured in the documents known as the Pandora Papers. One of them is Jordan's King Abdullah, who is secretly holding millions of dollars in offshore tax havens and spent part of his fortune on lavish homes around the world. The documents also implicate current presidents Uhuru Kenyatta of Kenya and Guillermo Lasso of Ecuador, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair, and former associates of the Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, as well as associate of Russian President Vladimir Putin. More than 600 journalists contribute to the reporting from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which was compiled over 2 years. The materials come from 14 global financial services firms dating as far back as the 70s, though most of the files are from the past 25 years. The whistleblower who leaked tens of thousands of pages of internal Facebook documents has come forward. Former Facebook product manager Frances Haugen spoke publicly for the first time on CBS's 60 Minutes.
Facebook has demonstrated they cannot act independently. Facebook over and over again has shown it chooses profit over safety. It is subsidizing, it is paying for its profits with our safety. I'm hoping that this will have had a big enough impact on the world that they get the fortitude and the motivation to actually go put those regulations into place.
Haugen's revelations were which were behind a sweeping investigation by the Wall Street Journal showed Facebook executives had significant understanding of the way its products are implicated in issues including child safety, political misinformation, and human trafficking. Haugen is testifying before a Senate panel Tuesday. Lawmakers are also pursuing Facebook as part of a federal antitrust case and over its role in the January 6th Capitol insurrection. In Afghanistan, at least 5 people were killed Sunday in an explosion outside a Kabul mosque. A funeral service for the mother of a Taliban spokesperson was underway at the time of the attack. No one's claimed responsibility for the bombing, but attacks by ISIS-K have increased since the Taliban takeover in August. Meanwhile, the Norwegian Refugee Council warns Afghanistan's economy is on the brink of collapse as the humanitarian crisis continues to grow. Over 18 million people rely on aid to survive, with 1 in 3 Afghans facing acute hunger. This according to the UN World Food Program. In India, at least 8 people were killed in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh on Sunday after a vehicle plowed into a demonstration led by farmers. The car was owned by a federal minister whose son was arrested in connection with the attack. Farmers have been resisting 3 pro-corporate agricultural laws enacted by Prime Minister Narendra Modi for about a year. They vowed to intensify pressure on Modi's government to repeal the laws, which deregulate agricultural markets and roll back key labor and income protections. Millions of farmers and opponents of the reforms have staged multiple strikes across India since last November. In Libya, officials detained some 4,000 refugees, including children, during multiple raids Friday. The United Nations says at least 1 refugee was killed, at least 15 injured in the crackdown. On Sunday, Libya's Coast Guard intercepted a wooden boat carrying some 500 refugees attempting to reach European soil. Many of them were from Sudan, Somalia, Bangladesh, and Syria. Refugees have reported facing torture and other violent and inhumane conditions at Libyan detention camps. Doctors Without Borders warns over 3 million people in northern Syria are facing shortages of water as crucial sanitation infrastructure has been destroyed after a decade of war. The humanitarian group says even when water is accessible, it's at times contaminated and unsafe to drink, making Syrians vulnerable to contracting waterborne diseases and other health issues, including hepatitis. Qatar held its first ever legislative election Saturday to select 2/3 of the advisory Shura Council. Qatar does not allow political parties, but the council has legislative authority over general state policies in the country's budget. Hoping to make history, a handful of women ran in the elections. None won their seats. This is candidate Aisha Hammam Al-Jassim.
I just say I'm strong. I'm capable. I see myself. I'm same fit like you. As a man, I don't see myself. I am weaker. If you want to see me as a week, that is up to you. But I am not a week. I'm in administrations.
In the run-up to the vote, Qatari officials detained at least 21 citizens who were peacefully protesting laws around the election that bar certain people from running and voting. In the Canary Islands, Spanish scientists warned Sunday a volcanic eruption on the island of La Palma is becoming more aggressive, shows no signs of ending anytime soon. A new crater was also discovered in the Cumbre Vieja volcano, which has been gushing out lava for weeks, destroying hundreds of homes and forcing the evacuation of thousands of residents. Officials lifted a stay-at-home order, citing improving air quality after the eruption triggered the release of toxic gas clouds. Taiwan's military scrambled fighter jets over the weekend in response to two major incursions by the Chinese Air Force. Over 75 planes flew into airspace designated by Taiwan as an air defense identification zone on Friday and Saturday. This follows joint U.S., Japanese, and Australian military exercises in the South China Sea. And after the U.S., U.K., and Australia announced a new strategic military alliance in the Asia-Pacific known as AUKUS. Back in the U.S., House Speaker Nancy Pelosi set a new target date of October 31st to pass the bipartisan infrastructure bill after delaying last week's vote amidst fractures within the Democratic Party. Progressive Democrats have said they will not vote on the $1 trillion bill without a firm commitment to also vote on the larger 10-year reconciliation package that would expand the social safety net and combat the climate crisis. President Biden met with Democratic lawmakers Friday and reportedly told them that after talks with conservative Democrats Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, the proposed top-line budget of $3.5 trillion would likely need to be slashed to between $1.9 and $2.3 trillion. But in a boost to progressives, Biden said he supports passing both bills in tandem and believes Democrats can gather the support to do so. He spoke after meeting with lawmakers Friday.
It doesn't matter when. It doesn't matter whether it's in 6 minutes, 6 days, or 6 weeks. We're going to get it done.
The House passed a bill last week that would end sentencing disparities between offenses linked to crack cocaine and powder cocaine. The policy dating back to the so-called war on drugs in the 1980s has disproportionately locked up black Americans at a rate of 18 to 1 compared to whites. Advocates say the accompanying Senate bill, which has at least three Republican co-sponsors, has a chance of getting the 60 votes it needs to pass there. Here in New York, a judge sentenced environmental and human rights lawyer Stephen Donziger to the maximum penalty of 6 months in prison for contempt of court. The misdemeanor charges were linked to a lawsuit brought by Chevron, which has been targeting Donziger ever since he successfully sued the oil giant in Ecuador on behalf of indigenous people whose land was contaminated by Chevron. Donziger has already spent over 2 years under house arrest, and the UN and other rights groups have called for his release. This is Donziger in a social media video posted after his Friday sentencing.
It's very clear Judge Preska wants me to serve my six-month sentence immediately so that even if I get exonerated on appeal, I still will have served a sentence for a crime I never committed. And again, another example, I think, of the punitive nature of what's happening. It's almost unheard of for someone convicted of a misdemeanor in the United States not to be let out pending his or her appeal.
And in other news from New York, a statue honoring George Floyd was vandalized Sunday, just 2 days after its unveiling ceremony. Police footage shows an unidentified white man on a skateboard throwing paint on the bronze statue. Floyd's sculpture is being displayed at Union Square, along two others honoring the late Congressmember John Lewis and Breonna Taylor. The busts of the three were created by the artist Chris Kamabuchi. The statue of Floyd had previously been vandalized just 5 days after it was first unveiled on Juneteenth in Flatbush, Brooklyn. It was marked with a logo linked to the white supremacist group Patriot Front. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, bands off our bodies. Thousands march across the country in hundreds of demonstrations in a national day of action to protect abortion rights. We'll speak with the president of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America and hear the moving testimony of Congress members talking about their own abortions. Stay with us.
sign. Wait till the world is mine. Visions I vandalize, cold in my kingdom size. Fell for these ocean eyes. You should see me in a crowd. I'm gonna win, there's nothing to tell. Watch me make them bow. One by, one by, one, one by, one by. You should see me in a crowd. Your silence is my favorite sound. Watch me make them bow. One by, one by, one, one by, one by, one. Count my cards, watch them fall. Blood on a marble wall.
You Should See in a Crown by Billie Eilish, one of the headliners of the Austin City Limits Music Festival that's taken place this weekend. Also, her brother Phineas pledged money to Texas Planned Parenthood because of the almost complete abortion ban in Texas. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Thousands march Saturday in more than 600 protests across the United States with the message, bans off our bodies, amidst increasing state restrictions on abortion. This year alone, more than 600 restrictions were introduced, with at least 90 enacted into law. Saturday's actions came in response to a near-total ban on abortions that went into effect in Texas September 1st. The law bans abortions after about 6 weeks, before most people even know they're pregnant. This is Top Chef host and author Padma Lakshmi addressing a massive Women's March for Abortion Rights in Houston, Texas.
The bill doesn't even allow abortion in cases of rape or incest. Have you experienced rape or sexual violence, Governor Abbott? I hope not. But I have. Multiple times. And I'm sure many people here today have too. When I was raped at 16, the only saving grace was that I didn't become pregnant. When asked if it was reasonable to tell a rape victim that they can't get an abortion, Abbott said, well, don't worry about it, because we're going to eliminate rape as a problem. Really, Governor? Really? Because 8 out of 10 rapes are committed by people the victim knows, and only 1% of all rapes and attempted rapes result in felony convictions. I know how sexual violence can make people feel powerless, and this bill is a knife in the heart to those very same people.
A federal judge in Texas is now considering arguments from the Justice Department over whether to suspend the Texas ban while courts consider its legality. Other states have similar abortion bans in the works by Republican state lawmakers, including Arkansas, South Carolina, South Dakota, and Florida. This is a protester at a rally Saturday in Miami.
My own rights were being violated at that point. I have my rights as like a person in the future and a person now. I'm 17 years old, so I am kind of like the face of change in a way, because we are the new generation, so we need to make sure that our rights are heard, understood, and we need to make sure that like the people in power that can actually make change listen to us, the people.
Thousands of protesters also marched Saturday in Washington, D.C., outside the U.S. Supreme Court, where the conservative majority could impose more abortion restrictions in the coming months. On December 1st, the court will hear a case concerning Mississippi abortion law that could overturn Roe v. Wade, the landmark 1973 Supreme Court decision that legalized abortion. Ahead of the nationwide action, several Democratic House members shared their personal experiences getting abortions themselves. At a hearing Thursday on the Texas abortion ban by the Committee on Oversight and Reform, they gave deeply moving testimonies. This is Missouri Congressmember Cori Bush sharing how she had an abortion after being raped at 17.
In the summer of 1994, I was a young girl, all of 17 years old, and had just graduated high school. Like so many black girls during that time, I was obsessed with fashion and gold jewelry and how I physically showed up in the world. But I was also very lost. For all of my life, I had been a straight-A student with dreams of attending college and becoming a nurse. But high school early on was difficult for me. I was discriminated against, bullied, and as time passed, my grades slipped, and along with it, the dream of attaining a full scholarship to a historically black college. That summer, I was just happy that I passed my classes and that I finished high school. Shortly after graduating, I went on a church trip to Jackson, Mississippi. I had many friends on that trip, and while there, I met a boy, a friend of a friend. He was a little older than I was, about maybe 20 years old. That first day we met, we flirted, we talked on the phone. While on the phone, he asked me, could he come over to my room? I was bunking with a friend and hanging out and said he could stop by. But he didn't show up for a few hours, and by the time he did, it was so late that my friend and I had gone to bed. I answered the door and quietly told him he could come in, imagining that we would talk and laugh like we had done over the phone. But the next thing I knew, he was on top of me, messing with my clothes and not saying anything at all. What is happening? I thought. I didn't know what to do. I was frozen in shock, just laying there as his weight pressed down upon me. When he was done, he got up, he pulled up his pants, and without a word, he left. That was it. I was confused, I was embarrassed, I was ashamed. I asked myself, was it something that I had done? The next morning, I wanted to talk to him. I just wanted to say something to him, but he refused to talk to me. By the time that trip ended, we still hadn't spoken at all. About a month after the trip, I turned 18. A few weeks later, I realized I had missed my period. I reached out to a friend and asked the guy from the church trip to contact me. I waited for him to reach out, but he never did. I never heard from him. I was 18. I was broke, and I felt so alone. I blamed myself for what had happened to me. But I knew I had options. I had known other girls who had gone to a local clinic to get birth control and some who had gotten abortions. So I looked through the yellow pages and scheduled an appointment. During my first visit, I found out that I was nine weeks pregnant. And then there, the panic set in. How could I make this pregnancy work? How could I, at 18 years old and barely scraping by, support a child on my own? And I would have been on my own. I was stressed out knowing that the father wouldn't be involved and that I feared my parents would kick me out of the home. The best parents in the world, but I feared they would kick me out. My dad was a proud father and always bragging about his little girl and how he knew I would go straight to college and become attorney general. That was his goal for me. So with no scholarship intact and college out of the foreseeable future, I couldn't bear the thought of disappointing my dad again. I knew it was a decision I had to make for myself, so I did. My abortion happened on a Saturday. There were a few other people in the clinic room, waiting room, including one other young black girl. I overheard the clinic staff talking about her, saying she had ruined her life, and that's what they do, they being black girls like us. Before the procedure, I remember going in for counseling and being told that if I move forward with this pregnancy, my baby would be jacked up because the fetus was already malnourished and underweight. Being told that if I had this baby, I would wind up on food stamps and welfare. I was being talked to like trash, and it worsened my shame. Afterwards, while in the changing area, I heard some girls, all white, talking about how they were told how bright their futures were, how loved their babies would be if they adopted, and that their options and their opportunities were limitless. In that moment, listening to those girls, I felt anguish. I felt like I had failed. I went home. My body ached, and I had this heavy bleeding. I felt so sick. I felt dizzy, nauseous. I felt like something was missing. I felt alone, but I also felt so resolved in my decision. Choosing to have an abortion was the hardest decision I had ever made. but at 18 years old, I knew it was the right decision for me. It was freeing, knowing I had options. Even still, it took long for me to feel like me again until most recently when I decided to give this speech. So to all the black women and girls who have had abortions and will have abortions, we have nothing to be ashamed of. We live in a society that has failed to legislate love and justice for us. So we deserve better. We demand better. We are worthy of better. So that's why I'm here to tell my story. So today I sit before you as that nurse, as that pastor, as that pastor, as that activist, that survivor, that single mom, that congresswoman, to testify that in the summer of 1994, I was raped, I became pregnant, and I chose to have an abortion.
St. Louis Congressmember Cori Bush speaking in the House on Thursday. A bill banning abortions at 8 weeks in Bush's home state of Missouri was passed in 2019, but is on hold during legal challenges. Missouri Republicans say they plan on introducing an even more restrictive measure modeled on Texas's near-total abortion ban. Seattle Congressmember Pramila Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, also shared her own experience Thursday about getting an abortion.
You, as one of the 1 in 4 women in America who have had an abortion, and for you to understand how I ultimately decided to have an abortion, I have to start earlier with the birth of my first child, Jenik. Jenik was born at 26 and a half weeks while I was on a 2-year fellowship living in India. They weighed only 1 pound, 14 ounces, and upon birth went down to a weight of just 21 ounces. Jenik was so small, they fit in the palm of my hand, the size of a medium-sized squash. For 3 months, we did not know if Jenik would live or die. They needed multiple blood transfusions, had to be fed drop by drop, and constantly had their heart stop and start. We returned to the United States after 3 months. In those early, intensely difficult years, Jenik had hydroencephalus, water on the brain, seizures, and repeatedly returned to the emergency room because of life-threatening pneumonia. The fact that Jenik is a 25-year-old beautiful human being is a true miracle and the greatest gift in my life. At the same time that Jenik was born, I was also fighting to keep my legal permanent resident status, married to a U.S. citizen with a U.S. citizen child now. In the end, I was able to return to the United States with Jenik, provided that I started from scratch to qualify for citizenship. As a new mom taking care of a very sick baby and recovering from major surgery myself, I was struggling. I experienced severe postpartum depression and post-traumatic stress disorder that was only diagnosed after I contemplated suicide and realized I needed to seek help. My marriage did not survive. We split custody of Jenik, and I was a part-time single parent. Shortly after, I met a wonderful man who is my husband today. I knew I was not ready to have another child, so I religiously took my daily contraceptive pill. Despite that, I became pregnant. I consulted with my doctors, who told me that any future pregnancy would likely also be high risk to me and the child, similar to what I had gone through with Jenik. I very much wanted to have more children, but I simply could not imagine going through that again. After discussions with my partner, who was completely supportive of whatever choice I made, I decided to have an abortion. 2 decades later, I think about those moments on the table in the doctor's office. A doctor who was kind and compassionate and skilled, performing abortions in a state that recognizes a person's constitutional right to make their choices about their reproductive care. For me, terminating my pregnancy was not an easy choice, the most difficult I've made in my life. But it was my choice, and that is what must be preserved for every pregnant person. Until 2019, I never spoke publicly or privately about my abortion. In fact, I did not even tell my mother about it. Some of it was because, as an immigrant from a culture that deeply values children, and in an American society that still stigmatizes abortion, suicide, and mental health needs, I felt shame that I never should have felt. 2 years ago, I decided to tell my story as a member of Congress because I was so deeply concerned about the abortion ban legislation that was coming out from states across the country. Today, I am testifying before you because I want you to know that there are so many different situations that people face in making these choices. Whether the choice to have an abortion is easy or hard, whether there are traumatic situations or not, none of that should be the issue. It is simply nobody's business what choices we as pregnant people make about our own bodies. And let me be clear. I would never tell people who don't choose to have an abortion that they should do so. Nor should they tell me that I shouldn't. This is a constitutionally protected, intensely personal choice. I did not suffer the economic issues that so many poor and black and brown and Latinx people suffer. I did not suffer from living in a state that does not allow pregnant people to make these choices. And unlike one of my colleagues who is testifying today, I had the privilege of experiencing the world in a post-Roe v. Wade time where abortion was established as a constitutional right. Because of the cruel Texas abortion ban and the other state abortion bans currently being litigated by those unaffected by the outcome, many people may not have the same choice as I did. That is unacceptable. Abortion bans are not just a political issue. They do real harm to people across the country and in our most vulnerable communities. I am so proud today to be testifying alongside fellow women of color members of Congress about the need to protect our right to control our bodies. It is time to make the Women's Health Protection Act law, to repeal the Hyde Amendment, and to remove the stigma around abortion care and reproductive health choices.
That's Washington Congressmember Pramila Jayapal of Seattle. California Congressmember Barbara Lee also testified at Thursday's hearing about having an abortion.
I'm sharing my story, even though I truly believe it is personal and really nobody's business, and certainly not the business of politicians. But I'm compelled to speak out because of the real risks of the clock being turned back to those days before Roe versus Wade, to the days when I was a teenager and had a back alley abortion in Mexico. I was raised in El Paso, Texas, and attended Catholic school. So, of course, growing up, sex education was non-existent. Adolescence, sexual and reproductive health were not discussed in a meaningful way, and because of that, I honestly wasn't sure how you got pregnant. Most of what I learned about sex and relationships was from pages of magazines and hearsay from my peers. I lived in a loving, extended family household with my wonderful parents and grandparents who wanted me to make straight A's, practice the piano day and night, and of course, stay away from boys. Now, after grammar school, we moved to California, and later, when I just turned 16, I missed my period. I was confused, afraid, and unsure, not knowing if I was pregnant or not. I didn't know what to do. Now, in those days, mind you, this is in the mid-1960s. Women and girls were told if you didn't have a period, you should take quinine pills, sit in a tub of water, or use a coat hanger if nothing else worked. My mother noticed I became introverted and very quiet, so she asked me what was going on with me. At that point, I told her everything. I told her that I maybe not could be pregnant. She responded with love. She was supportive and sympathetic and took me to the doctor who confirmed I was pregnant. Now, my mother asked me if I wanted to get an abortion. She didn't demand or force me, but understood that this was my personal decision and a choice that I needed to make, and she would support me regardless. Now, mind you, I was the first black cheerleader in my high school, got very good grades, was active in my church, and a member of the Honor Society, and an accomplished pianist. In fact, I won 2 music scholarships. So I felt embarrassed and thought if anyone found out, my life would be destroyed. It was so important for me to have someone I trusted to help me with this decision. So once I made this decision prayerfully, one of my mother's best friends in El Paso helped me access the abortion I could not get in California. When my mother told her what was going on, she told my mother to send me to her in El Paso because she knew of a good, competent, and compassionate doctor, yes, who had a back alley clinic in Mexico. She was kind and loving, took me to Mexico to have a DNC abortion procedure. Remember, I just turned 16. Now, I was one of the lucky ones, Madam Chair. A lot of girls and women in my generation didn't make it. They died from unsafe abortions.
California Congressmember Barbara Lee sharing her personal abortion story during a hearing on Capitol Hill Thursday on the attacks on reproductive rights. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Saturday, hundreds of rallies took place across the United States amidst a mounting assault on reproductive rights. The rallying cry of the day was, "Bans off our bodies." The protests and marches came 1 month after Texas's near-total ban on abortions went into effect. This is Planned Parenthood Federation of America President Alexis McGill Johnson addressing thousands at a protest in Washington, D.C.
This year alone, we have seen nearly 600 restrictions introduced in 47 states. So no matter where you live, no matter where you are, this fight is at your doorstep right now.
For more, we are joined by Alexis McGill Johnson, President and CEO of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund. Alexis, welcome back to Democracy Now! This was a massive weekend of action, and particularly in Texas, where the near-total ban has taken effect. Tens of thousands of people not only marched but attended the Austin City Limits Music Festival, where one musician after another spoke out. In fact, Phineas, Billie Eilish's brother, pledged 100% of his proceeds to the Texas Planned Parenthood. Can you talk about what you think this action means on this day that is the first day of the Supreme Court back in session, the first time they are meeting in person without Brett Kavanaugh because he has COVID?
Amy, thank you so much for having me this morning, and thank you for playing those testimonies in such long clips from our representatives who spoke out so eloquently and beautifully about their own abortion experiences. That's what this weekend was. It was a movement moment of patients telling their stories, of providers telling the challenges of activists and leaders and everyday people showing up to demonstrate that, you know, more than 80% of Americans believe that Roe should be the law of the land, that they should have access to safe and legal abortion. And yet in state after state, these horrific restrictions and bans are continuing to further erode our ability to access our constitutional right. And so what this weekend did was really just the beginning to let the courts know, to let lawmakers know, to let state lawmakers know that the people will not stand for our rights being encroached upon in such a way. And it's amazing that we have artists like Billie Eilish, like Phineas, like, you know, Gracie Abrams shouting from the stage, along with folks like Megan Thee Stallion and, you know, and people, the one in four women, trans men, non-binary folks who also have had abortions, telling their stories and reducing abortion stigma. It was really incredibly powerful.
For people to understand what this near total ban in Texas is, explain what's happened to the Planned Parenthood clinics, to the other women's health clinics. I mean, this ban off our bodies in Texas is a real coalition effort. No one particular name is attached to it.
No, absolutely. I mean, look, this is, again, a moment where we are all facing existential crisis around our ability to access abortion. And Texas is just really the opening salvo. We have an unconstitutional 6-week ban with a bounty hunter provision attached to it so that anyone who supports anyone getting access to an abortion after 6 weeks has effectively rendered Roe meaningless. You know, this is what's happening right now, and not just at Planned Parenthood, at independent providers across the state. They are, you know, they've become crisis hotlines, right? People calling, panic, trying to figure out where to go. Trying to get in before, before 6 weeks. And also, you know, Texas already has a number of other restrictions that that complicate the ability to access abortion, 24-hour mandated waiting periods, mandated counseling and ultrasounds. And so the reality is 85% of our patients in Texas were already coming to us after 6 weeks. And it means that those who can travel out of state are now having to identify places in Oklahoma and New Mexico. Folks in Oklahoma and New Mexico are now having to travel outside of their own states, and it's having a tremendous impact, a ripple effect really across the country.
And so the disproportionate impact on Black and Brown people, not to mention overall lower income people.
Completely. And I think that's always what this last year, I think in particular, has laid bare, that our healthcare crisis is a function of systemic racism. And so the impact that is having on these clinics, as well as on the people who, again, have to take off work, right? They have to plan to travel. We had one patient who drove 1,000 miles to Aurora, Colorado, by herself, because she didn't know if someone driving with her out of Texas would be cause for them to get in trouble. It would not, but she still didn't know. And so people are making these calculations where they can, but that impact of having to go out of state is certainly going to fall disproportionately to BIPOC communities.
I wanted to ask you about WIPA, about the Women's Health Protection Act that Congress, the House, passed overwhelmingly. And I want to go now to the Senate, because that's where it would have to be voted on next. Now, the Democrats are in charge by a hair, but they are in charge. But still, it looks like it cannot pass. And looking at recent Los Angeles Times coverage of one senator, Susan Collins of Maine, she said, "I support codifying Roe. Unfortunately, the bill goes way beyond that. It would severely weaken the conscience exceptions that are in the current law." She said she found parts of the bill's language extreme. Collins said she's talking with other senators on a potential bill that truly would codify Roe. She's going to vote against WIPA. Can you explain what it is, its significance, and what is your strategy for dealing with the Senate?
Yes. So WIPA is the Women's Health Protection Act. It is a law that would stop these horrific bans like SB8 in Texas and would prevent further erosion by states on our federally constitutionally protected right to access abortion. The idea that Susan Collins, who claims a pro-choice mantle, also is someone who has put Brett Kavanaugh into a lifelong appointment, has decided to go in this direction against the Women's Health Protection Act is really quite alarming. You know, we are trying to ensure that we are obviously on calls with all of our senators, trying to make sure that they will support this incredibly important legislation. But we're also, activating folks in the streets to have those same conversations, to make sure that people know that the majority of Americans support safe and legal abortion. It is a majority position, and reproductive freedom has always been under constant attack. So it's really incredibly important for us to continue to push our lawmakers, our senators, to get them on record, knowing that this, in the middle of this year, when the Supreme Court is taking up Jackson versus Women's Health, is going to be a conversation that we're going to have for the next 12 months.
So let's talk about the Mississippi law that will be heard, the oral arguments, on December 1st, banning most abortions 15 weeks into a pregnancy. This is the one that many see as the greatest threat to Roe v. Wade overall. Although right now, I mean, you can just tell us the numbers across this country. It's virtually being overturned.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that you're absolutely right. I think what Texas has the potential to do is usher in a de facto end to Roe, because there are 20 five other states that are looking quite closely at, you know, their ability to engage in copycat legislation starting, you know, as early as the next legislative session in 22. And what we have with Mississippi, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization is a 15-week ban. Jackson Women's Health is the sole provider of abortion in Mississippi. This 15-week abortion ban is another clear violation of our constitutional right to an abortion, and that the Supreme Court has taken up this case is, and that it is willing to consider overturning 50 years of precedent, makes it, I think, incredibly momentous at this moment. And so this is the first direct challenge to Roe v. Wade since Justice Amy Coney Barrett is sitting on the bench. And that is incredibly concerning for all of us.
Alexis McGill-Johnson, I want to thank you for being with us. President and CEO of Planned Parenthood Federation of America and Planned Parenthood Action Fund. She spoke at the Washington, D.C. Protest this weekend. When we come back, from one activism to another, climate activists Vanessa Nakate of Uganda and Greta Thunberg of Sweden in Milan, Italy. Stay with us.
Wearing SPF 3000 for the ultraviolet rays. Made it to the island on the last of the outbound planes. Got a trunk full of Simone and Celine, and of course my magazines. I'm gonna live out my days. Won't somebody, anybody, be the leader of a new regime? Free the keeper of the burns out seen another day.
Leader of a New Regime by Lourdes. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We end today's show looking at the climate emergency. Thousands of climate activists marched Saturday through Milan, Italy, as leaders from around the world met for the pre-COP26 summit during a year that's seen record-breaking heat waves, floods, and fires. Climate activists also spoke last week at the UN-sponsored Youth for Climate Conference in Milan. This is Ugandan activist Vanessa Nakate.
My name is Vanessa Nakate, and I live in Kampala, Uganda, a country that has one of the fastest changing climates in the world. In the past few years, I have seen more and more how the climate crisis is affecting the African continent, which is ironic given that Africa is the lowest emitter of CO2 emissions of all continents, except for Antarctica. Historically, Africa is responsible for only 3% of global emissions, and yet Africans are already suffering some of the most brutal impacts fueled by the climate crisis. Rapidly intensifying hurricanes, devastating floods, and withering droughts. Many Africans are losing their lives, while countless more have lost their livelihoods. The droughts and floods have left nothing behind for the people, nothing except for pain, agony, suffering, starvation, and death. A recent World Bank report warned that we could see up to 86 million people in sub-Saharan Africa alone displaced due to rising sea levels, desertification, declining freshwater, and food scarcity. Over the past few months, there have been deadly heat waves and wildfires in Algeria and devastating flooding in countries like Uganda and Nigeria. And the UN has declared that Madagascar is on the brink of the world's first climate change famine. Tens of thousands of people are already suffering catastrophic levels of hunger and food insecurity after 4 years without rain. Who is going to pay for Madagascar? And of course, this is not just happening on the African continent. Hurricanes Irma, Maria, Dorian, and Harold have left some islands in the Caribbean and Pacific totally uninhabitable. 6 million Bangladeshis have become displaced as a consequence of climate change. By 2050, 17% of the country's coastline will vanish underwater, creating an estimated 30 million climate refugees. The International Union for the Conservation of Nature recently announced that there are now well over 38,000 species on its red list, the best available catalog we have of the species facing extinction. Who is going to pay for the lost islands of the Caribbean and Pacific? Who is going to pay for the communities who must flee the Bangladeshi coastline? Who is going to pay for the thousands of species that fall off of the scientists' red list and into the oblivion? How long shall the land mourn? How long shall the farms lay in ruins? How long shall the herbs of every field wither? How long shall the animals and the birds perish? How long shall children be given up for marriage because their families have lost everything to the climate crisis? How long shall children sleep hungry because their farms have been washed away, because their crops have been dried up because of the extreme weather conditions? How long are we to watch them die of thirst in the droughts and gasp for air in the floods? What is the state of the hearts of the world leaders who watch this happen and allow it to continue? Our leaders are lost and our planet is damaged. Loss and damage used to be something people thought of as happening only in the global south. As we have seen in the recent months with wildfires in California and Greece and floods in Germany and Belgium, loss and damage is now possible everywhere. Everywhere I go, leaders fall over themselves to say how they will achieve net zero by such and such a date to mitigate the worst impacts of the climate crisis. Sometimes I hear leaders talk about the need to fund adaptation efforts where mitigation will no longer be enough.
Ugandan activist Vanessa Nakate speaking Thursday at the UN-sponsored Youth for Climate Summit in Milan, Italy. Also speaking there was the Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg.
Climate change is not only a threat. It is above all an opportunity to create a healthier, greener and cleaner planet which will benefit all of us. We must seize this opportunity. We can achieve a win-win in both ecological conservation and high-quality development. Fighting climate change calls for innovation, cooperation and willpower to make the changes that the world needs. We need to walk the talk. If we do this together, we can do this. When I say climate change, what do you think of? I think of jobs. Green jobs. Green jobs. We must find a smooth transition towards a low carbon economy. There is no planet B. There is no planet blah. Blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah, blah. This is not about some expensive, politically correct green act of bunny hugging or blah, blah, blah. Build back better, blah, blah, blah. Green economy, blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah. Net zero by 2050, blah, blah, blah. Net zero, blah, blah, blah. Climate neutral, blah, blah, blah. This is all we hear from our so-called leaders. words, words that sound great, but so far has led to no action. Our hopes and dreams drown in their empty words and promises. Of course, we need constructive dialogue, but they've now had 30 years of blah, 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 and where has that led us? Over 50% of all our CO2 emissions have occurred since 1990, and a third since 2005. All this while the media is reporting on what the leaders say that they are going to do instead of what they are actually doing, and then not holding leaders accountable for their action, or rather inaction. And don't get me wrong, we can still do this. Change is not only possible, but urgently necessary, but not if we go on like today. They say they want solutions, but you cannot solve a crisis that you do not fully understand. You cannot balance a budget if you do not count all the numbers. And as long as we ignore equity and historic emissions, and as long as we don't include consumption of imported goods, burning of biomass, etc., etc., and as long as clever accounting is one of the most efficient ways of reducing emissions, we won't get anywhere. And the climate crisis is, of course, only a symptom of a much larger crisis, a sustainability crisis, a social crisis, a crisis of inequality that dates back to colonialism and beyond. A crisis based on the idea that some people are worth more than others and therefore have the right to exploit and steal other people's land and resources. And it is very naive to believe that we can solve this crisis without confronting the roots of it. Right now, we are still very much speeding in the wrong direction. 2021 is currently projected to experience the second highest emission rise ever. Only about 2% of government recovery spendings have been allocated to clean energy measures. And according to a new report by the UN, global emissions are expected to rise by 16% by 2030 compared to 2010 levels. Our leaders' intentional lack of action is a betrayal towards all present and future generations. The people in power cannot claim that they are trying, because they are clearly not, as they continue opening up brand new coal mines, oil fields and pipelines, pretending to have ambitious climate policies while granting new oil licenses, exploring enormous future oil fields, and shamelessly congratulating themselves while still failing to come up with even the bare minimum and long overdue funding to help the most vulnerable countries deal with the impacts of the climate crisis. If this is what they consider to be climate action, then we don't want it. They invite cherry-picked young people to meetings like this to pretend that they are listening to us, but they are not. They are clearly not listening to us. And they never have. Just look at the numbers. Look at the statistics. The emissions are still rising. The science doesn't lie. But, of course, we can still turn this around. It is entirely possible. It will take drastic annual emission cuts, unlike anything the world has ever seen. And as we don't have the technological solutions that alone can deliver anything close to that, that means we will have to change. We can no longer let the people in power decide what is politically possible or not. We can no longer let the people in power decide what hope is. Hope is not passive. Hope is not blah, blah, blah. Hope is telling the truth. Hope is taking action. And hope always comes from the people.
Climate activist Greta Thunberg of Sweden speaking in Milan, Italy at the UN Youth for Climate Summit. Saturday, thousands of climate activists marched through Milan. Italian police and riot gear clashed with climate activists who are calling on the COP26 policymakers to wean the world off fossil fuels. And that does it for our show. Very happy birthday to Becca Staley. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for two positions, Director of Finance Administration and Human Resources Manager. Learn more at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're joined by Doug Henwood to talk about a recent article he wrote on the ruling class.
Who rules America? The most important question. Listen in, because Doug Henwood knows a lot about the answer.
Julian Assange's father, John Shipton, joins us with an update on his son's case.
John Shipton has been touring the United States trying to save the life of his son, Julian Assange.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
We need to know our enemy, because the task of changing society begins with understanding who holds power. In 1915, the great Irish socialist James Connolly said, "Oh yes, the ruling class are worthy of study. The natural history of the ruling class is a fascinating interest. You begin with interest, you proceed with awe and admiration, you deepen into hatred, and you wind up with contempt for the nature of the beast. You realize that the capitalist class is the meanest class that ever grasped the reins of power." Jacobin Magazine's spring 2021 issue is devoted entirely to an examination of the ruling class. We speak today with Doug Henwood, who has an article in Jacobin entitled, "Take Me to Your Leader, The Rot of the American Ruling Class." Doug Henwood is the editor of Left Business Review and the host of the radio program Behind the News. Doug Henwood, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Always good to be here.
Doug, we need to know our enemy, because the task of changing society begins with understanding who holds power. Who holds power now, and has this changed over the last 50 or 100 years?
Well, that's a pretty long topic, but I would say, in general, the ruling class of society consists of, it doesn't map easily onto the very rich. A lot of the very rich are just not that politically engaged or politically thoughtful. And certainly the preferences of the corporate class and Wall Street matter politically, but they also have to articulate with a political class that engages with the state and in political parties, the business wing of the Democratic Party and the Republican Party is a problematic little assembly, so we could talk about that maybe a little bit later. But much of our politics does reflect the interest of the very rich, but they can't always articulate it directly, so they need a political class to develop an agenda for them. So elite politicians, Trump certainly did not qualify, but Obama certainly did. But also there's a kind of permanent political class of pundits and people who go in and out of government in the private sector. The famous revolving door, where people go from lobbying to corporate positions to high government positions, where they hand out favors and contracts and deregulate and do all those kinds of things that make businesses very happy. So yeah, I think this partnership between the very rich, but with a political class that really makes their rule possible. What's changed over the years is that there was once a much more coherent elite in the country, the old WASPs that ran things essentially from the founding of the country through probably the mid-70s, late-70s, they were, in just a sociological sense, a much more coherent formation than what we have now. They went to the same schools. They married out of the same pool. They belonged to the same clubs. They summered in the same vacation spots. Now it's much more, divided by business sector, by geography, not like the old WASPs based in the Northeast. It's much more geographically divided and much more, I think, politically divided class as well. When we talk about the divisions in the society, you know, elite pundits are constantly complaining about how we just can't get together and have common ground and govern in a responsible, civilized fashion. I think a lot of that is traceable to the fact that the elite is just not the unified force that it once was through the late 20th century. It's just much more of a fragmented RVs.